From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The White House race only gets hotter, especially if you're John McCain. Yesterday, the Arizona senator picked up the Potomac primary wins in Washington, D.C. and Maryland. He also took Virginia, where Mike Huckabee put up a good fight. The victories are edging McCain closer to the GOP candidate seat. And as for the Democrats, yesterday was all Barack Obama. He swept the Potomac primaries and stacked up key delegate points. Joining me now to sort through the numbers is Ron Elving. He's NPR senior Washington editor. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Farai.
So how many delegates did McCain pick up?
McCain picked up a little over 100, possibly as many as 113, depending on how they sort out Maryland. But he got everything in Virginia, all 30 delegates, despite the fact he only won by 9 percentage points. That's the way the Republican rules work. You can win certain winner-take-all states, no matter what your plurality or majority may be. You get all the delegates. So he did that in Virginia and the District of Columbia, and he'll get virtually all of the delegates in Maryland. So he picked up somewhere between 100 and 113 delegates. It puts him pretty much out of sight. He's got more than three times as many as Mike Huckabee.
But let me ask you this. When you say, lights out, he's pretty much out of sight, why is Huckabee sticking with the race?
Because there's another spot on the ticket besides the
Yes, that is so true. Well, let's look at the demographics on both races, Democratic and Republican. Can we say anything about the trends by race, by first-time voter, any trends among voters for the Democratic or Republican races?
By and large, the Democratic demographics were what we've seen in the past. In Maryland in particular, we saw, again, where the African-American vote was overwhelmingly for Barack Obama, but he did not do comparably well among whites. Now, we did see a deviation from that in Virginia, which was the largest state that was voting yesterday. And in Virginia, we saw for the first time a substantial portion, in fact, about half of the white vote going for Barack Obama. He also won among white men. He did not win white women. But if you look at all men, he carried two-thirds of all men, and he carried 60% of all women in Virginia. So Virginia was demographically the ideal Barack Obama success story. It was not a one-color success story. It was a multicolored. He even did better than he's done anywhere else among Latinos. So Virginia is really, if you will, the marquee state for the Barack Obama coalition that he wants to put together.
What about independent voters? Particularly first-time voters seem to have come out.
Yes. In fact, first-time voters are largely a creation in this particular cycle of the Barack Obama campaign. That's why they came out. It isn't just because they're suddenly interested in the political process. It's Obama. And in Virginia in particular, Obama did so well among independents that he was the reason largely that Mike Huckabee threatened John McCain at all in Virginia. Otherwise, John McCain would have counted on 5 to 10 percentage points more from independents who were being attracted over to the other side by Barack Obama.
Before we let you go, there's so many ways to crunch the delegates on the Democratic side, but specifically in terms of delegates that the two candidates have won in the primaries and caucuses, how are they standing now?
Yes, and sometimes called earned delegates. In that category, Barack Obama is opening up something of a lead. In fact, at this point, he even has a lead overall, but he has about 100 delegate lead among what some people call earned delegates, that is, those that are the result of a primary or a caucus. But because he still has a deficit of about 80 among those superdelegates who are going because of their position in the party or because they're elected officials, those people still are favoring Hillary Clinton, although about half of them haven't committed yet, and that cuts Barack's overall lead down to about 20.
Well, Ron, thanks again.
My pleasure, Farai.
Ron Elving is NPR Senior Washington Editor. He joined us from our NPR studios in Washington, D.C. To dig a little deeper into the primaries and the presidential race, we have also got Michelle Bernard. She heads the Independent Women's Forum, a conservative think tank based in Washington, D.C., plus Todd Shaw. He's an assistant professor of political science and African American studies at the University of South Carolina. Welcome, folks.
Good morning.
Michelle, let's start with Senator McCain's campaign. He just about got the Republican nomination on lock, but Mike Huckabee is giving him a run for his money among conservatives. Does this mean that McCain is going to face a really hard time with conservatives in the general election?
I think, you know, it's interesting. I think I read a few weeks ago Peggy Noonan described it as the slow-burning civil war within the Republican Party continues. And I think that that is what we are going to continue to see all the way through the general election in November. I think eventually you will see a large part of the Republican Party rally around John McCain. We're beginning to see that happen now, and it will continue slowly but surely. But there are people in the, you know, in the most conservative ranks within the Republican Party, particularly the talk radio show folks like Rush Limbaugh and Laura Ingraham, Ann Coulter, who really, really dislike John McCain. And I think that unless he is able to really have a sort of come to Jesus moment with the very conservative part of the Republican Party, this is going to be very difficult for him. I mean, the big question within the Republican Party is who is going to be the standard bearer of the party after George Bush leaves the party. And a lot of people do not feel that John McCain is the right man. But on the other hand, do you want to live out in the wilderness and, you know, risk losing the White House and having a Democrat in the White House rather than a Republican simply because you feel that John McCain does not stand by all conservative values?
Todd, let's turn to the Democrats for a second. Hillary Clinton has had some shakeups in her campaign office, and yesterday her deputy campaign manager, Mike Henry, stepped down, and she also lost Patty Doyle, her chief campaign manager. Is this just a question, you know, when you have Michelle talking about who's going to carry the torch, is this a question of who's going to carry the mantle for the Democrats and a real fundamental question of whether, you know, more experience and more time in Washington is going to be what Democratic voters want?
Well, Fry, what you're beginning to see in these polls is a way in which the experience question is being trumped more by the change question. I've been watching some of them recently, and they've indicated that voters are now being really pulled into this change message. And so literally Clinton is having to change sort of within her own infrastructure her campaign infrastructure to make some changes that are key, particularly to attract donors and to indicate that she really is quite serious about gaining ground again.
Speaking of change, there's a lot of first-time voters coming out. You heard from NPR's Ron Elving that Barack Obama seems to be the person who's really attracting first-time voters. I'm going to start with you, Michelle. Do you think that these first-time voters who don't have a track record, may not be on the top of the pollster's list to understand, are going to break Democratic or Republican in the general election?
I think that they are probably going to break Democratic, and again, it goes back to this whole notion of change. You know, I feel like there are two standard bearers of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. We've got Ronald Reagan for the Republicans. We have John F. Kennedy for the Democrats, and you saw the same sort of thing when John F. Kennedy was president, and as he was looking to be elected. Not since that period of time have we seen young people so electrified, and you know, Barack Obama has a phenomenal way of engaging and reaching people across all genders, all sexes, all, you know, religious and ethnic backgrounds. And young people are feeling energized. They're feeling, you know, called upon to become a part of this, of what they feel is this great movement that Barack Obama is including them in. And I think for that reason, you will see a lot of the young people being attracted to the Democratic side. You know, I don't know if you got an opportunity to watch Senator McCain's speech after he won the Potomac primaries, and then also watch Senator Obama's speech after he won the primaries. But the contrast was absolutely amazing. I mean, Barack Obama was surrounded by so many young people, and the room was eclectic and it was energetic. And you know, he's, I think, maybe 46 years old. And then, you know, right after he spoke, you were able to witness John McCain give a speech. His speech was good substantively as well. However, you know, he was surrounded by people who were much older. The energy in the room was very, very different. And if you are a young person and you're looking at, you're sort of doing a compare and contrast of the two candidates, I would venture to guess that most young people are thinking Barack Obama is my man.
Well, let's go to a little bit of the Arizona senator speaking last night in Alexandria, Virginia.
To encourage a country with only rhetoric rather than sound and proven ideas The trust and the strength and courage of free people is not a promise of hope. It's a platitude.
So that is Senator McCain attacking in a veiled way Senator Barack Obama, and Senator Obama responded. But when you look at this issue, Todd, certainly what Michelle was talking about, is it a question that Senator Barack Obama is only going to face that critique from conservatives or Republicans, or is he also facing a critique of how much substance he's put on the table from Democrats or liberals?
I think there is, in fact, a lingering critique about whether or not Obama can meet that challenge with regards to the experience question, etc. Right now, I think, however, he has sort of turned the tables in that the great level of mobilization that he has been able to really spur among young people, among independents, the way in which, in fact, he kind of gets these overflow crowds, and most importantly, both in funding and in terms of the margins of win that he's garnering in these last eight primaries, really is proving, at least on one side, that as of now, that criticism is a little bit thin. And so I think McCain, as Clinton is having to learn, should learn, that it's really going to take more than simply, you know, attacking hope. I mean, what does it mean to attack hope among Americans who, you know, the whole idea of the American dream is a notion of optimism. And so it's really kind of difficult to attack hope. You really have to get at something deeper and more substantive than sort of those types of veiled criticisms.
All right. Well, Todd and Michelle, that's all we have time for. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Todd Shaw. He's an assistant professor of political science and African American studies at the University of South Carolina. Also, Michelle Bernard. She's president and CEO of the Independent Women's Forum, a conservative think tank based in Washington, D.C. And she joined us from our NPR studios in Washington. Just ahead, a broader look at politics, and on our bloggers roundtable, the rapper formerly known as Nasty Nas sports his N-word t-shirt at the Grammys. So when does the controversial album of the same name drop? And will he face a backlash? This is NPR News. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The primaries are not the only big news in politics. We've got more from Capitol Hill and beyond with Democrat Donna Brazil, the author of Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics, and Robert Trainum, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for CNA, the Comcast Network, and professor at George Washington University. Welcome, folks.
Hi, Farai.
So, Donna, let me start with you. The president is hoping that the stimulus package, with its payments of up to $600 a person, are going to fire up the economy. But how are the presidential candidates attacking this issue? What are they saying they want to see America do with the economy?
Well, I think both candidates have addressed not just a short-term problem of putting more cash into the economy, but they're also looking at long-term. How do the United States compete in a global environment? How do we retrain our workers? How do we prepare, you know, our society for a 21st century economy that is a lot more diverse than the economy of our parents or grandparents? So I think both Senator Clinton as well as Senator Obama put forward innovative ideas to not just provide tax credits to small businesses to spur innovation, but also looking at how we improve education, how do we assist those who are in dire need of falling off or not making ends meet. For now, the Democrats have embraced the stimulus package as a short-term solution, but long-term, we have to do something about the twin deficits, the budget deficit as well as the trade deficits. We have to live within our means, and we have to ensure that we go forward with an economy that lifts up all people and not just those on Wall Street.
Robert, do you see any of the candidates putting something substantive on the table, either for the economic issues at large or for the mortgage crisis? Because we've seen some movement on the federal level to talk to lenders about giving a 30-day grace period to people in trouble. Do you see
yes.
the Go ahead, please.
Yes, I do believe so. Senator Clinton has already outlined a pretty detailed economic proposal as it relates to getting out of the housing crunch. Senator Obama has yet to do so. Senator McCain on the campaign trail has said repeatedly that he obviously did not vote for the Bush 2001 tax cuts, but he is now for the extension of those tax cuts because he believes that in the age of economic uncertainty, the tax cuts will work. So they both have, meaning Clinton and McCain, have outlined some specific proposals, of which have been criticized. Senator Obama is a little bit short on the details, although he does talk about it on the campaign trail.
Robert, you probably have not gone on the Obama website, but Senator Obama has gone beyond the freezing of mortgage interest rates that Senator Clinton has called for. He's called upon the federal government through the Federal Housing Administration to look in these cities, look at how the foreclosure rates is disproportionately hurting these communities. He's talked about the subprime crisis and what it has done to devastate the minority communities. So there's no truth to the fact that Senator Obama has some thin record on this when he's been very specific. And, in fact, he's in Wisconsin today talking about the economy, talking about how we stem the tide of jobs being taken overseas and how we deal with not just the subprime crisis, but how we deal even more in this broad new global economy that we're all a part of.
I appreciate that, and thanks, Donna, for the reminder. I did go to Senator Obama's website, and if you do take a look at it, you're right. He does talk about the economy, but as it relates, if I could have finished, as it relates to Senator McCain as well as Senator Clinton's plan, they're much more specific than Senator Obama's.
Let me turn to another issue that's really...
Senator McCain just recently had to say on Meet the Press that perhaps he needs a tutor, and he was going to ask former Senator Phil Graham to help him understand economic issues. And then he said he might have to read Alan Greenspan's book.
All right, Donna, I've got to throw another topic in, and I'll toss it to you again first. Senator Obama has been increasingly embraced by black voters who seemed a little skeptical at first. There's always this question of whether or not, if he's elected president, he'll be caught between a rock and a hard place. Some African-American civic leaders might say, you got to serve our community. And other citizens might say, hey, aren't you that non-racial, everybody's in that together guy? In the case that he wins president, and it's certainly still anybody's race, do you think he will be caught between Acilla and Charybdis on race?
I think we're underestimating the political maturity, not just of the African-American community, but the white community in this country and Latinos and others. We have, for so long in our history, put people in a group identity box, thinking that when they see black, they vote black. When they see white, they vote white. That's not the case. What you're seeing today in American politics, especially on the Democratic side, is that that people are excited about what Obama is offering them. And I think what black voters are saying is that, yes, we like what he's saying. We like what he's proposing. We believe that he is going to be a president for all the American people. This is not about electing a black president or a white president or a female president or anyone else. It's about electing a president who understands the enormous challenges this country faces in the future and the things that we must do as citizens of this great democracy to pull our country out of the mess that we're in across the world. So I think Obama has shown and demonstrated that he's not the black candidate. He is running to be the Democratic nominee in the fall. And African Americans have shown enormous political maturity, but so have whites, who have given him overwhelmingly their vote of confidence as well.
Robert, he has done very well among white voters, particularly last night. He also said this is the new American majority. This is what change looks like when it happens from the bottom up. He's running better economically among higher income voters. Is this really a bottom up question?
It is, and you're absolutely right. I mean, Senator Obama, the breadth of his victory last night was breathtaking. You know, he exceeded every single income group. He also exceeded every single quote-unquote label group, if you will, African-Americans, Latinos, older individuals, senior citizens. So he is overperforming, if you will, in those groups, which goes back to Donna's point, and I agree with her, that the American people are very savvy, they're very sophisticated. And also, to keep in mind, Senator Obama does not talk about race on the campaign trail. He doesn't inject it. He doesn't invoke it. So when people listen to him and when they see him, they see presumably the Democratic nominee for their party, not necessarily someone that's running for president because he's black.
Donna, what about Senator Clinton's campaign shakeups? The person who warned her not to compete in Iowa has stepped down, Mike Henry. How is she doing in terms of leadership on her campaign?
Well, you know, I think she's in a bit of a pickle right now, having bypassed states that could have given her more delegates Heschy had a ground game to go with the terrific air game, which is, you know, a way of saying that you cannot just advertise your message. You must also deliver it to the people directly where they live, where they eat, where they play, and where they pray. I've been involved in enough campaigns to know that shakeups can be a good thing. But in the case of Senator Clinton, what are they shaking up and why? I think they're shaking up a very stagnant campaign that didn't plan for any contest post-Super Tuesday. And the fact is that we still have over 1,100 pledged delegates or earned delegates at stake, about 400 undecided, undeclared superdelegates like myself. I'm a superdelegate. I make no bones about that. And I think going forward, she has now set down a marker to beat Obama by winning in two states, Texas and Ohio. Now, it may come down to Pennsylvania, and Robert knows that state very well. And if Senator Clinton can't win one, she's in trouble.
When you look at this race, you can see, Robert, that there's a lot of wrangling over identity and how it plays out, loyalty. Several Latino leaders say that Patty Solis Doyle took the hit for losses that Bill Clinton may have caused on the race issue, and she was the former leader of the Clinton campaign. Could this cause some bad blood between Latinos and the Clinton campaign?
Possibly, although I don't think it's that deep. You know, if you take a look at the Clinton campaign, Farai, you can do a circular firing squad and everyone would be guilty as charged. There was a lot of things they did right and there's a lot of things they did wrong. If you take a look at the financial angle, if you take a look at the grassroots angle, everything they did wrong is catching up to them now. Senator Clinton was in Texas earlier this week where she spoke in front of a large Latino crowd. The Latino crowd there specifically has said that they will embrace Senator Clinton. The reason being is because she has a long history with the Latino community, at least in Texas, but also nationwide. And they're very skeptical of Senator Obama because he does not have that history with Latino Americans. So the real question is whether or not Senator Clinton can get at least 60% of the vote, Latino, African-American, white, in Texas and Ohio. Here's why. She needs that number in order to keep up with the delegate game. If she does not, she is in deep, deep trouble. She's in deep trouble now, but moving on to Pennsylvania, as Donna mentioned, I do know something about that state, and that's a state that's very similar to Ohio in terms of its blue-collar background, in terms of being in economic distress. That's why the Clinton campaign is saying, we're just holding our fire, you just wait until you see what we have in Ohio and Pennsylvania. It's a risky strategy for I because they're putting all of their eggs in one basket, and it's all or nothing for them.
Donna, finally and very briefly, please tell me a little bit about Maggie Williams, who takes over the Clinton campaign top spot.
Maggie is a friend. She's tenacious. She's very disciplined. She's very organized. I think her primary function at this point is to take everyone out of their Northern Virginia headquarters and send them down to Texas with a one-way ticket. That will motivate them to work their butts off for Senator Clinton and help her secure enough delegates to catch up with Senator Obama.
Well, Donna and Robert, thank you so much.
Thanks, Fry.
Thank you.
Donna Brazile is a Democrat and author of Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics, and she joined us by phone. Robert Trainum is Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for CNN8, the Comcast Network, and a professor at George Washington University. He was at NPR's Washington Bureau. Members of the Writers Guild of America are back at work today. The three-month labor dispute with Hollywood producers was put to rest last night. Members voted overwhelmingly to end the strike. The dispute centered on what writers should be paid for work distributed over the Internet. So did the writers get what they wanted? That's the question we pose now to Larry Wilmore. He's a member of the WGA's negotiating committee. He's a longtime television writer and producer, also the senior black correspondent for Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Here's a clip of Larry on The Daily Show before the strike.
American blacks love African art, African clothes, African music. We're just not that crazy about Africans. Frankly, they kind of overdo it, you know? So for blacks to support Obama, he's got to make up his mind. Is he African or American? Because he can't be both. That doesn't make sense.
You are so wrong, Larry. How you doing?
Good, Fry. How are you?
I'm doing great. So you're back on the job just
yes.
starting today after 3 months. How does it feel?
Oh, it feels great. The energy here in New York is really fantastic. People are really excited to get back to work.
Now, your show, The Daily Show, like several other shows, went back into production before the strike was over. Was it hard for you to sit on the sidelines, and is there any bad blood over that?
It really was difficult, you know. It was difficult for all the people on shows whose shows went back, you know, the late night shows, Jay and Conan and all those shows, Colbert. And, you know, during a strike, emotions run high for all different types of reasons. And, you know, people like Jon Stewart and Jay are kind of caught in between, you know, these, you know, the fact that they're being pretty much being forced to go back, and they have all these employees that they're the boss of, but they don't want to, you know, burn bridges with the guild or do anything wrong. They're trying to do all the right things, but they still have to produce a show. So it's a tough position to be in.
Let's break down exactly what shook out of this strike. Help us understand what the WGA gained or lost, in your opinion.
I don't think there were any losses in the NBA. The losses were the money that you lose while you're out on strike, you know, and the hardship that it caused to, you know, all the ancillary businesses and people who were affected by it that aren't in the Writers Guild. And those are always very tragic and a sad part of the strike. But in terms of the actual NBA, the writers did gain a foothold in the new media. We gained jurisdiction in new media, which was a huge sticking point. And also some definitions for residual payments for streaming, for downloads, and other areas of the Internet.
But this is a very, it's an emergent area. There's not a lot of revenue yet being generated. Was
That's
this
right.
strike really wagered on the idea that we have to have a foothold in this digital world, even if there's not a lot of money flowing yet, because we know that there will be at some point?
That's absolutely right. And the Guild kind of felt like they were cheated out of a lot of DVD revenues because a definition was made when the business was very young. And, you know, the company said, look, we're not making a lot of money right now. Just take your residuals based on 20% of the total, not even 100%. You know, we have all these distribution costs. We have to package these cassettes. You know, when we're making money, we'll revisit it. And then they never did, you know. And it was always a sticking point in every negotiation. So the Guild said, okay, fine, let's get a foothold early, make some definitions that we can work off of and work from and evolve and whatever over the years. But if we're shut out in the beginning, it's going to be hard to get into that.
So, Larry, I want to ask you to play our senior black correspondent for the Writers Guild. Now, I've heard of some folks whose jobs have disappeared, black writers specifically, but I'm sure many, many other writers, because the shows just couldn't make it through the strike. So is this a situation where most people gained, but some people, including some black writers, just lost it all?
I hope not. I haven't heard of any stories yet because we just went back today. And I mean, you say senior black correspondent. I don't know if you want me to make a joke out of this or not. So I don't know what you're referring to. I know some.
I've heard some cases of where the show staffs were shuffled and people were let go, not based on race, but the fact is that, you know, the network seemed to be making some hardcore decisions about what they're willing to do.
If people were fired during the strike and the show's going on, those people have to be rehired. It was part of our strike settlement policy. So they're actually not allowed to do that. Those people will get their jobs back. If a show does not come back, if a show is actually canceled, then there's no job to go back to, and that's kind of one of the fallouts of a strike, so that's unfortunate. But a writer, it's an unfair labor practice to actually fire someone because they are striking.
All right. Well, Larry, we will definitely keep in touch with you about the strike, and have fun.
Thanks, Rai, and you know, we'll keep in touch, and I'll give you more updates on the campaign, maybe then.
I would love that, and we would absolutely love that.
And watch The Daily Show tonight. I'll be on it.
Oh, absolutely.
Great.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye now.
Bye. That was Larry Wilmore. Today he is back to work on Comedy Central's The Daily Show after striking 3 months as a member of the Writers Guild of America. And we called the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. They weren't available to provide a comment on air, but here's a portion of a statement on their official website. We have concluded 2 groundbreaking labor agreements with our directors and our writers that establish a partnership through which our business can grow and prosper in the new digital age. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. When our show ends, that's usually when our blog heats up. Last week was no exception. Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he's here to explain. Hey.
Hey, Farai.
So the final few moments of last week's Bloggers Roundtable got heated about Afrocentric names. How did people respond?
Well, in a word, they were shocked. Here's the context. The conversation last week focused on Tarika Wilson. She was an Ohio woman who was shot and killed by police during a drug raid. Now, one of the bloggers said that readers on her site were blaming the victim because Wilson was knowingly dating a drug dealer and had drugs in the house. So blogger Desmond Burton made a big picture argument saying that low-income urban blacks needed to be more responsible. And here's part of what he said.
In looking at that story, I saw pit bulls being mentioned, drug dealing, stereotypical underclass Afrocentric names.
Don't tell me you're blaming Afrocentric names.
We're not talking about Barack. Barack is an authentic African name. But if we're talking about Lakeisha, Trikeisha, Lokeisha, there's a theme.
So we continued that conversation online, and here's some of what folks had to say. Shane wrote, if Tarika's name was Patricia, would that have made the shootings less justifiable? And a reader using the alias Whole9 wrote, like it or not, Desmond has a point. There's been a lot of evidence that clearly suggests opportunities are diminished for people with certain sounding names. And Desmond came back on our site to say that he expected his fair share of barbs from our listening audience, but stands by his original comments. And that conversation is still on our blog if people want to hear the original clip and see some of the discussion about it.
Just in time for Black History Month, lots of fireworks.
Right.
Speaking of Black History Month, we are taking a month-long look at black images in film. So how have our bloggers dug in on that one?
Well, we linked to an article from the Seattle Times which posed the question, are movies and TV shows useful in teaching about black history? A professor quoted in that article said that a lot of times, for example, movies put forth the notion that slaves were on these huge, sweeping, large plantations, and she says that's not the case, and she pointed out some other misconceptions about black history that have been cemented by films like Glory or Roots. So on our blog, Ernice wrote, I think one should learn about black history from history books and not take what we see on film as the truth. Filmmakers use poetic license to make films more viewable. Emoji Odorinde wrote, I don't fault any filmmaker for taking a creative license. When done right, it could be ingenious.
So what else has got people talking on the blog?
Well, we're talking about the results of yesterday's primary elections, Steven Spielberg's announcement that he's severing ties with the Beijing Olympics over Darfur, and some beef between Beyonce and Aretha Franklin over the Grammy Awards this week.
Oh, yeah. That is serious. I won't go into it, but the Queen of Soul is not pleased.
And it's on our blog.
All right, Jeffrey, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me in our studios at NPR West. We're back with our Bloggers Roundtable. Folks are on fire about the rapper Nas wearing an N-word t-shirt to the Grammys, for starters. With us is media consultant Carmen Dixon. She writes the blog All About Race. Also author and DJ Richard Graves, who writes the blog DJ Black Adam, and Jay Anderson of the blog Average Bro. We should mention that you just won a Black Weblog Award in the Blog to Watch category. Congratulations, Jay.
Thank you.
And welcome, everybody.
Hi, Farai.
Hello.
So let's start with politics. Last night, Barack Obama won all three of the Potomac primaries. That's Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. John McCain beat Mike Huckabee. And after last night's wins, Barack Obama now leads Hillary Clinton in the count of what is called earned delegates, delegates that you win in the primaries or caucuses. So one thing that I've noticed is that a lot of people are now saying, okay, this could happen. There could be a black president. There seems to have been, among some people, a tipping point of opinion. Jay, are you finding that's the case?
I think that's absolutely the case. I think, you know, coming into the race, a lot of people were undecided about Obama. Let's just be honest. Until the tide really turned back in December when the Clinton campaign and their surrogates started making some really unfortunate comments, a lot of the black community was not behind, the Obama campaign. But I think the momentum of Iowa moving forward, you know, South Carolina, Super Tuesday, all these things have compounded. And I think, you know, the net result of that is obviously the African-American community is behind Obama. But I think that momentum is really just taking over for all the other demographics as well.
Carmen, there was a lot of broad support for the Obama campaign, and the Clinton campaign is having some issues at the top in terms of who's running the campaign, but it's still any person's race. What are you looking at in terms of how you process what's going on as a blogger and as a journalist?
I'm looking at two things. I'm looking at what's on the surface, the numbers, and I'm also listening for this dog whistle that we're talking about, about signals coming from, in particular, the Clinton campaign. I never count the Clintons out, and I understand she's in a must-win situation. So I am listening very carefully to how they frame going forward.
And for your part, Richard, when you think about this race and you think not just about these two candidates, but Senator John McCain, Mike Huckabee, there's a lot of different demographics in play. Conservatives seem to be in play. There's all these first time voters. Are you paying attention to those groups as well?
Yeah, I've been looking at the Republican side of things. I'm finding it very funny how the evangelical vote is being manipulated. Should I say?
Why do you say manipulated?
Well, they, in my opinion, from what I observe about evangelicals, I'm sure that they generally would support Huckabee, and I was surprised that a lot of them were going to support Romney. With McCain now being the candidate right now, he doesn't really make the evangelical right happy, but he seems like I think they're going at it to look at who can actually beat Hillary or Barack if they happen to win the whichever one wins the primary.
Now, Carmen, this is definitely right up your alley when you say that you're listening for the dog whistle. There's this question of whether voters are too sensitive. Gwen Ifill, the senior news correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS, was on Meet the Press over the weekend, and here's some of what she said.
You make the slightest comment, there's a great groundswell, sub rosa argument among women who feel that this election is being unfairly taken from them. Feminists who hear every insult, which is, you know, we heard what happened this week on NBC with the reporter who made the comment about Chelsea. That sort of thing starts just, it just starts a little roll going among people who are feeling aggrieved anyway. And that's the problem in a tipping point election when any version of that kind of insult can affect the outcome, probably more than the superdelegates.
So, Carmen, are folks just too thin-skinned? I mean, this is a time when these questions of gender, race, personal identity, you know, hope, all these, you know, sometimes cliches are caught up, you know, with how we personally feel about ourselves. Are folks a little... Do all these barbs cut close to the bone?
I think some barbs do, but I don't think they all do. And what I think is happening is for the first time, the media is waking up to what the populations, particularly people of color or women, we hear in comments. We've heard comments in boardrooms and in office places and in our schools and our neighborhoods that we sort of felt the barb or we wanted to talk more about the person making a particular comment. But we were the only person hearing it. So there was no one else to express that to. I have to say, I was shocked when the mainstream media picked up on Hillary Clinton's comment about the civil rights not becoming real until Johnson signed the act. And then all of a sudden, there was an explosion. I remember the night that it happened, I was talking to a close friend and expressing that, how can no one pick this up? And then everyone saw it. And I think that's remarkable and fantastic. I don't think that's oversensitive.
So you think that in a way that in America right now there is a good sensitivity? There's people are kind of clicking into these issues that might have been below the radar?
Absolutely. I think we're having a national dialogue about all sorts of things, not just race, not just gender, but how we talk to each other. I think that's great.
Richard, do you think it's positive? Do you think that people are being more open, sharing more, or are folks still just being overly sensitive?
I think that it's positive. I don't think people are being overly sensitive. I think that it's opening up a segment of America who really didn't understand how things that they may have said or things that we may hear might affect African Americans or women. I think it's making people realize that, hey, you know, making them think about the things that they say and how they can affect people and how people are listening. So I think it's just making people pay more attention, and thereby I think that they're learning from the whole thing as it goes along.
Richard, last week, MSNBC's David Schuster said Chelsea Clinton was, quote, sort of being pimped out, end quote, by her mother's campaign. He's been suspended for his comments. So when did pimp go from derogatory to something that not only hipsters but mainstream journalists use?
Well, I think that that journalist was a victim of the same thing that Imus was a victim of, and that was trying to be a little too hip. I guess taking too many cues from the popular culture, maybe listening to too many 50 Cent songs and thinking that the word pimp can be used to talk about you know, the daughter of a former president, you know, using any type of connotation with that. So I think he was trying to be a little bit too hip. And I think, you know, with the way that this election has been going and with the media and, you know, with the MTV and the MySpace, everybody's trying to be hip and get that young vote. And I think he might have just thought that it was something that he could get away with saying. I don't think he meant any offense intentionally, but unfortunately, he didn't think about what he said.
Carmen, what about family members? Are they off limits, or is it fair game to talk about the proxies and the family members as well as the candidates themselves?
Family members are not off limits as long as you're addressing their political involvement. It would have been fine if he said, wow, Chelsea's come out of nowhere and all of a sudden she's pushing hard like she's a political expert. No one would have, we wouldn't be talking about it. But he used such a derogatory term. It was unacceptable.
We just you were talking about Richard, this being like, you know, MSNBC trying to be a rap star, but what about those actual rap stars always bringing up controversy? Sunday night at
goodness.
The Grammys, Nas walked the red carpet wearing a T-shirt printed with the N-word in big letters across his chest. His wife, the singer Khalees, and a group of women with them all wore similar getup. Now, Nas is no stranger to the N-word controversy. He made waves after announcing plans to title his upcoming CD The N-Word. And we, of course, are using the N-word as a code for the N-word. And the album was scheduled to hit stores this month, but it's been pushed back indefinitely. But before the award ceremony, the CNN reporter Brooke Anderson asked Nas what message he was trying to send with the T-shirt and album.
It's all the experiences we go through every day of all ethnicities, black, white, and different. We've all at some point felt discriminated on, you know, whether it's in Dominican Republic, whether it's in China, whether it's in Iraq, with soldiers getting their heads blown off for reasons we don't know why. And, it, you know, the meaning of the word is supposed to be ignorant. So there's money being made off us poor, innocent, so-called ignorant people. So no longer just black people, niggas today, it's also me and you.
So it's kind of like a reverse We Are the World or something. Richard, what do you think about that?
First, I'm confused. Maybe I went to sleep in my grammar and history classes, but I didn't know that that word actually had a root in meaning ignorant. I thought that the word came from a Spanish word that meant black, a Spanish-Portuguese word, and was later used to be a negative term used for black slaves. So I don't understand Nas's pseudo-logic, but obviously to me, the man just wants to make money. He knew that there was a, you know, there was that the that there would be some excitement, or he calls, you know, some attention to his new album, and he'll sell albums because of it. Controversy sells, and I believe he knows that. He's familiar with that. But as far as his justification, his rationale for it, it's ridiculous and it's insane. And I hope that no one in the, you know, in the black leadership, you know, comes out and support his ignorance, because it's just utterly ridiculous. The man is, to me, it's just buffoonery at his best.
And Jay, you've been blogging about this.
Yes, I have. And I'll tell you, I mean, the thing about Nas is, let's just be honest. I mean, Nas has not had a great album since the Clinton administration. And we're not talking about the second term. We're talking about the first term. You know, I know a lot of people are going to get upset with that, all you hip-hop purists, and my brother himself is going to be very upset when he hears that. But seriously, I mean, when you're at a point in your career where your album titles are more exciting than the albums themselves, that's a problem. You know, I mean, he had Stillmatic. He had Hip Hop Is Dead. You know, and now, of course, we have the quote-unquote N-word. I just think, again, it's desperation from a person, you know, who's trying to remain relevant. And in a hip-hop game that honestly has changed, I mean, it's skewed towards younger listeners. I mean, you have your Soulja Boy demographic. And honestly, the sorts of things Nas is saying are just not interesting to the people that are actually still buying albums nowadays.
Now, Jay, before I move on to Carmen, would you be okay with him going for this kind of controversy if you thought his work was better?
I mean, come on. Let's be honest. Again, Nas, his last album was called Hip Hop Is Dead. And I think everyone was expecting this grand, I don't know, statement of some sort. But that didn't happen. I mean, the album was just not very good. You know, and on this same note, I don't think we can expect Nas to come with anything more hefty here, you know, taking on the N-word. I guess one other thing that was missed, and you didn't play it in the soundbite, Farai, but Nas also alluded to the voting rights of 1965. Yeah, 1965. In a little later in the soundbite, and I guess that was particularly illuminating. I mean, let's just be honest. Nas is getting information from forwarded emails, you know. So you can't really seriously. I mean, you can't take a guy like that seriously. What is he going to do next? Is he going to rhyme about Microsoft, you know, giving him money for forwarding emails. I mean, come on, man.
All right, Carmen, really. what do you think about that?
Just I want to echo what Jay said as far as the quality of his most recent releases. And maybe this album will be the second coming. I got a lot of heat on my blog when I first wrote about this album title. But from where I sit, Nas is no Gilster Gottheron. The revolution will not be televised, and it certainly, its anthem will not be a song titled The N-Word, period.
Well, now, that depends. If he has Timberland's production. I mean, I looked at, I think he gets Dr. Dre and Kanye, so maybe if he gets Timberland, you know, he might be able to do what he did for Justin Timberlake.
Because, you know, everybody just listens to beats. That's all it's really
of
about.
Course.
Yeah,
of course.
There was a song back in the 80s, a new wave song that said, you'll dance to anything. So maybe that's the new catchphrase for what's going on now.
How appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Well, guys, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Jay Anderson of the blog Average Bro. He was at NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Author and DJ Richard Graves writes the blog's DJ Black Adam. He was at NPR Chicago studios. And media consultant Carmen Dixon writes the blog All About Race. She was with me at the NPR West studios. And you can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. No spaces, just nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we continue our film series with a conversation on power moves. What do Black filmmakers have to do to get their work out? I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.